Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Episode 312 of the Roguecast, recorded November 10th, 2020. Sorry, Tsushima.
All right, we're back. It's post-election times.
Yeah.
We're all breathing a little easier.
Yes, thank God.
We have a
not big... out of the woods, maybe, but
no. I'm still Muppet flailing armed Kermit inside. On the outside, on the outside, I'm calm, but definitely Muppet flailing on the inside.
That's reasonable. I think that's reasonable behavior, and even to be expected.
Yeah,
and maybe even admired.
Yeah. we should reach out across the aisle. I think we all been pretty. We used to keep the thing pretty non-political, and in these times. We've become a little more vocal about the fact that we're all a bunch of lefties.
Yep,
that's true.
But, you know, in the wake of the election, I feel like we should reach out and tell you that if you are a listener who did vote for Trump, to go fuck yourself.
Thought that was going to go in a different direction.
I wasn't sure Randy was going.
Hey, you know.
I thought you were going to suggest he use his flailing Muppet arms to flailing strangle someone. Yeah, we're...
I don't know. I think I'm just happy to be not watching cable news. I think I've consumed, like, hundreds of hours in the past week.
You know, if nothing else, you know, I don't think Biden was anybody here's first choice.
No.
Or that anybody was, like, super excited about him. But, can you just imagine, like he's already put out, like, that just that press release that's about, like, broadly about COVID.
Yeah,
and his thoughts on it, and the team he's putting together, and the dangers that it poses, It's like it's been treated seriously for the first time since it happened.
It's like having a president again.
Yeah, and I'm just thinking, can you just imagine, like, just not dealing with a tantrum a day?
Yeah.
A COVID team comprised of scientists and fact people? And
science not excoriated?
Yeah. So anyway, so we're all in a pretty good mood.
Yeah.
We got a decent chunk of comics this week. There was some good game stuff that came in this week. There's this D&D Heroes Feast.
Oh man, that is so cool.
Which is
it's a D&D cookbook.
It's a D&D cookbook. And it is really nice, full-on hardcover.
Beautifully done, illustrated, or not illustrated, but like beautiful photographs. And it sort of like has the recipe on one page and like a picture of it on the other.
Yeah.
And flavor text in there that sets it within one of the D&D fictional realms, whether it's the Forgotten Realms or Dragonlance or Eberron.
Yep.
And there's neat little flavor text. The one I was just telling Nick about earlier was it's a pretty simple dish of bacon-wrapped asparagus with a few little things to spruce it up. But in their history, they say that, oh, yeah, asparagus, or like they say sparrow grass is what they call it, which I thought was kind of clever,
yep.
Was like a staple elven diet in the Forgotten Realms. And, you know, they use it in a lot of dishes. But that their kindred, the half-elves, who are always a little more human to them, they decided, maybe some protein in there, and they wrapped it in bacon.
I like the idea that the half-elves wrap everything in bacon. Like, if a half-elf is shooting an arrow at you, it's going to have bacon on the end of it.
Half-elf arrow.
Yeah, and it's broken down to, like, dwarven cuisine and elven cuisine. And you know how some cookbooks can be a little, like, I don't know if I could make this?
Right.
I think most of these are doable.
Right. Well, I saw one that was in the I don't know if this is a section that was mostly dwarf stuff, but like one of them is like they're kind of like hearty meals, it looks like, you know. And like by that I mean like sort of staples, like so one was shepherd's pie.
Right.
But they presented it as a variant of it that was like a miner's dish for dwarven miners that would be a hearty food that they would eat. And it sounded basically it's shepherd pie, but it looked like a really good version with some fun flavor text. You can cook it, you know, like a teacher nerdy kids that are playing D&D to cook too with these. That'd be fun, I think.
Yeah.
And for the over 21 crowd, there is a alcoholic beverages in the back. There's some cool stuff.
When I heard y'all mention this, or I guess I saw, I wasn't working the day that we posted about it. I was like, oh, that's neat, but you know, not of particular interest to me. But then I flipped through it and I was like, these sound delicious, and I like the D&D vibe of the whole book, and I think I'm going to buy it.
And you've been cooking,
and I've been cooking a little bit more lately, so I will. I'm probably going to get this book.
You should make a feast for your D&D group, which can't meet because of the COVID.
Right.
But you should definitely make yourself some black pudding.
What is black pudding? Is that one of those ones that actually uses like blood? Is black pudding blood pudding?
I mean, I think some variant of it. Yes.
And then we've got the Star Wars Unlock. Unlock is the escape room games that
you play in like an hour.
Yeah, There's been a bunch of these, but this is the first. It's three games where you play, and the Rebels one is Escape from Ice Planet Hoth. The smugglers break out of a Star Destroyer, and Imperial agents rescuing Kyber crystals from the ancient moon Jeddah.
Yeah, I think we talked once or twice about having played some of the unlock games, and some of them are really cool. They use essentially a deck of cards, which you can only pull out a few at a time, and you have to sort of solve riddles and figure out things on the cards. And when you do, you get to go to another room or something like that, and then you're able to draw more cards. So the deck simulates an escape room. And these Star Wars ones look really cool. Like, the idea of being, that you get to do one where you're Imperial agents and one where you're smugglers and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Really cool. The Unlock games were fun just with thematically before.
Yeah.
But a Star Wars version?
I think we all want to try this.
I feel like this could be a really cool Halloween? Holiday gift type item for people.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Then there's Fate Condensed. Which is a little $8 Fate book. Basically, they describe it. Fate Core is the full design philosophy, the whole thing. Fate Accelerated is the beginner friendly streamlined, and Fate Condensed is the tight refined wallet friendly rules reference.
Okay, it seems like Fate Core would still be the best one to if you were just going to start with it, or Fate Accelerated.
Yep.
This one seems like it might be good for if you are into it and you're going to want to flip to those rules often.
Yeah.
But Fate is a neat little system. It's one of those game systems that's meant to accommodate any genre. So whether you want to play a sci-fi or a fantasy game or superheroes or anything like that, it should be able to accommodate.
Or you want to adapt whatever. They didn't mention adapting your license properties, such as Dave, your Flex, your Fate variant.
Right,
Flex,
and we've done like transformers and stuff that.
If you want to play yourself a West Wing game, this would be the rule set to
for
use.
Sure, or Supernatural or something
Supernatural,
like that.
There is the latest in the Rising series, where they have Thanos Rising and Death Eaters Rising, which is the Batman Who Laughs. They did that. And then the latest Marvel Champions expansion for Ant-Man.
I like Ant-Man. He's cool.
I've been buying all the Marvel Champions. At some point, I should play it again.
Yeah, this is a... are these always in the game? Are you teaming up with somebody? Yeah. Are you just dueling with another player?
It's a 1-4 player co-op, and there's a sort of story mechanic where you have... That each back comes, Ant-Man has, I'm sure, his villains, probably Yellow Jacket.
Yeah, maybe Yellow Jacket. I think Wasp is in there.
Yeah. So there's you use their cards and you build a deck of villains and problems, and the villains have an objective, and the heroes are trying to stop them before they get to it. Yeah, it's a fun game. All right, so we should talk about news for the week. There's not a ton, but what there is pretty notable. They have cast the Thunderbolt. They teased in Stargirl Season 1 the Thunderbolt, Johnny Thunder's Thunderbolt, a lot. They've cast him, and they have cast Jim Gaffigan, which is just about perfect.
In the comics, was he usually the dude who was wearing a suit kind of guy?
Johnny Thunder was, but the Thunderbolt is this big purple goofy guy.
Oh, you're talking about, right.
He's basically the genie.
Is he summoned by Johnny Thunder?
Yes.
Okay, is Johnny Thunder already on the show?
Yes.
No. But I don't think Gaffigan's going to be playing Johnny Thunder. I think he's voicing a CG Thunderbolt.
Remember,
he has the... I don't know if you remember this. He's got the pen, Dave. Is it the pen?
Yeah.
And you have the CU. He says the
yeah, the equation card. Thing.
So they've shown the pen and little purple sparks coming out of it, and it makes a little laughter. So I think they were hinting at it this whole time.
So is it going to be that kind of laconic Jim Gaffigan vibe to the genie thing?
Probably, but he'll be sort of wacky, I guess. I can totally see that.
Jim Gaffigan's a funny guy. I think his sort of sense of timing has always been one of the strengths of his comedy. This seems like it could be a fun role for him.
I think the best way to think about it is, remember Robin Williams as the genie?
Yeah.
I imagine Gaffigan doing basically that.
Yeah.
No.
Probably a little less coked up, but very similar. This is perfect. I'm super excited that we're actually going to get it. We also saw the trailer for the Lego Star Wars Holiday Special. It's coming on Disney Plus in a couple of weeks here.
It looks like both goofy and heartwarming.
Yeah.
There's some sort of time travel element where Rey, in the present of the Star Wars universe, gets to travel back to classic eras of Star Wars, it seems like.
And we also saw Mondo and the Child.
Yep.
Like, everybody, it's crossing over to all the Star Warses. And there's a ton of, like, inside joke references in there.
Yep.
There's a Han shot first with two different Hans.
There's a Lando opening, not Christmas, yes. but Life Day presents, yes. hoping for another cape. lots of, you know, goofy Lego-type humor where the Lego always kind of does the thing where they mash up those worlds pretty
yeah.
well.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It looks fun.
Yeah.
Director Andre Ovredal has put out an update on Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark Part 2.
Yeah, which I think, you know, that movie was Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark left room for a sequel, but I hadn't heard anything about whether it was moving forward until now.
So I guess they're excited about it, they're developing it, they have a story, but they don't know when it's going to happen.
But, like, the story is, like, written by the guys who wrote the first one. Yep. They attached the director who was the director of the Autopsy of Jane Doe.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And there was something else notable about it, too, I feel like, or some returning element.
Well, Guillermo del Toro.
Oh, Guillermo del Toro.
He's got a story by credit.
Right, and I think he wrote the story of the first one, yeah. too, I think.
Yeah.
By the way, just as a reminder, the guys who wrote that are the guys who are going to be writing the next Star Trek animated thing, the one that's about the... I forget what it's called already. What's the Star Trek animated one that Nickelodeon is doing? Yeah, that Janeway is doing. Is in.
Okay.
The one about the renegade kids who get a starship. Anyway, those are the same guys who did the first Scary Stories to Tell in Dark, which I really liked.
Yeah.
And,
that's great.
And I feel like they've got a good voice for that. So, they were the main people I wanted to see on board the sequel. And that they're on board makes me happy.
And then there's the big news. DC Comics has officially promoted Marie Javins to editor-in-chief.
So, let's answer the questions first. Who is Marie Javins?
So, Marie Javins has been... She's been working in the industry for, like, 30 or 40 years. I was actually looking for a rundown of her... But I believe, like, she worked at Marvel. She has done some indie stuff.
And is she generally in an editorial capacity?
Yes. Yeah, she's been an editor. I'm looking up her Wikipedia now. So let's see. She interned at Marvel Comics and Epic Comics. She was editorial...
Epic Comics, that'd be 80s then, huh?
Yep. She was editorial assistant and secretary for Mark Gruenwald. Became a full editor at Marvel and Epic. Edited stuff like Akira, Gru, and Earth-X. She was also a colorist. She's done a lot of around-the-world travel. She actually, for a while there, she would travel by boat and plane, or boat and train and car. And she, like, traveled all over Africa. She wrote some books about that. She blogged
that
for a year.
She's done that and been a colorist. She's worn a lot of different hats.
Then she worked with the Teshkil Media Group as a series editor of The 99, which is one of the sort of Muslim superhero world. She became co-editor-in-chief in August, and now she's official editor-in-chief.
So that's pretty cool.
Yeah. It seems like the comic creators that I follow on, like, Facebook and stuff like that, people who've worked with her, are all excited about it. They think this is definitely a good thing, and I'm kind of inclined to trust the pros.
So what does this mean for, like, Jim Lee? Is he stepping down? Or?
So Jim Lee is still publisher and chief creative officer.
Okay.
It says that she will be responsible for developing and overseeing the execution of the company's annual publishing schedule. She'll also lead the strategy for expanding worldwide consumer reach of DC publishing content and provide editorial and creative direction for DC imprints. So this is pretty notable.
Yeah.
At the same time, we have no idea what, like her initial plans will be or what will be going on early on, right? We don't...
So I know Marie a little bit. Like, we've been online friends. Like, I had followed her blog when she was traveling.
Randy, you starfucker.
and she's really smart. She's really well-liked. I don't have a sense creatively of, like...
Where her head is?
Like, I have a... There, the comic creators that I know online, like, I have a sense of, like, oh, well, that's their favorite character. Or, you know, like I know what they like a little bit. I don't have a sense of what Marie's favorite characters and stuff are, or what her vibe at the thing is going to be. But I know that someone who worked, like, under Archie Goodwin in Epic, I've seen several... I think Gene Ha called her, like... Basically he said Archie Goodwin is a good comparison.
And Archie Goodwin is like one of the most beloved editors of all time.
Yep. And she came in working for Mark Gruenwald, who also is one of the most beloved editors of all time. So
yeah.
Javins has the editorial background that is good.
So Randy, what I understand is you, who have not really liked anything DC has done for like 15 years or so overall, are like, you know what? Gotta keep my eyes open on this one.
Exactly. This is DC could finally get me back.
Yeah.
If they do this. And Of course, the answer is that she should just put Tom Taylor in charge of writing a bunch of stuff. But, yeah, I'm finally excited about DC again because I have not liked the people at the top. I still don't like Jim Lee having his hand in it that much because I think Jim Lee's sensibilities are too 90s.
Yeah.
But I also know that, like, death metal and the Batman and the stuff that's been going has been popular, and so it is possible what DC should do is stuff that I won't like.
Yeah.
So I don't know. We'll see. I'm curious to see if she can do stuff that will bring me back to it.
Bring back Groot.
Bring back Groot. He's had what, four publishers? She should move on to DC.
Yeah, it's time to move Groot into the mainstream DC universe.
Well, Groot's been what? He was at Marvel.
Right.
He started at.
By the way, I'm mixing up Usagi Ojimbo now, but I thought I thought Groot did exist. Yeah, he was at like Pacific Comics.
Pacific Comics, Epic Comics, Pacific Comics. Then went to Dark Horse.
Yeah, I was going to say Dark Horse.
And now, yes, he should go to DC.
Yeah.
Groot versus Batman.
Did I err?
I bet, though, that Sergio Aragonés retired, more or less.
I think so. I think he does a project here and there. He's been around in the business. He needs a siesta sometimes.
But I'll be interested to see what she does. The interesting thing we were talking about this a little bit before we were podcasting. When DC did Rebirth, they did Convergence.
The DC Rebirth thing.
Convergence was like their 2-month, and that was while they were moving offices to LA. Basically,
Convergence was like a sort of a micro event, like a 2-month event. Yeah. If I'm not mistaken,
you're saying we're coming up on another two-month event.
This is what I'm thinking. Remember, they set up a Convergence. They had a bunch of creators do it. It was a bunch of crossover
standalone stuff with alternate DC universes.
Yeah. And they did that while they moved everybody from New York to L.A.
Right.
They did a big, huge
change. Like a buffer before they did the big new initiative. And we think that DC might be in the midst of another buffer project.
They announced Future State,
yep,
which is all set and done and clearly outside of continuity, so don't have to worry about coordinating and that kind of stuff. And I'm wondering if Future State, the cynical among us, which includes me, were like, is this the last thing they're going to do and then they're going to cancel all publishing forever? But now I'm thinking, okay, no, maybe this is like the buffer so that Marie Javins can get her line up. She has 2 months to she's got more than that. She's got till March.
I might suggest that another reboot is not necessarily what DC needs, although I would maybe like it and you might like it, Randy, because it's another chance to sort of build things from the ground up.
Yeah.
But I think that's become such an albatross around DC's neck that I would rather she, find a new direction or reshuffle what the titles are or something.
I don't think that they should do another Crisis-type thing where they continuity reboot. What I do think they should do is what it looks like they're doing, which they canceled. They're shutting down all the books, and then they're going to... I wonder if they're going to launch a bunch of new number ones again.
Now, that would be okay.
I'd be fine with that. I also hope that she brings in new talent. And get some bigger writers.
Me too.
And not just the... Not to say that you can't get rid of Snyder. You can't get rid of Tynion. But they're good at what they do. They bring in an audience.
Yeah.
So I think that might be a little bit... But some new blood would be really, really needed.
I agree. A little diversity, too, would be nice.
Yes.
So we'll see what happens. And I expect that will be part of the goal.
You know,
the way that she's beloved, it seems like she could have some pull.
She will definitely have... I mean, this is one of the things that Quesada did when he ran Marvel Knights. He and Paul Miatti were so beloved, they knew so many people. And that's why they could bring in Kevin Smith, they brought in Paul Jenkins, they brought in people who had not been working in the industry.
I don't necessarily want to bring in Hollywood folks, because we've seen how that goes.
You know what would be cool? Is if they went ahead and just said, Tom Taylor, you're Justice League.
Yeah.
And, had a few big things like that.
If they give Tom Taylor Justice League, I'd be so happy.
The thing is, we know he can do that. He's done variations on it in both Injustice and in Deceased.
Yep.
And he's great at it.
Yep.
They really should.
Yeah.
Honestly, the artist he worked with on Deceased is great with those characters.
Yeah.
I'd keep that artist around.
Yeah.
And this would be an opportunity to maybe do something you and I... Teen Titans is one of those projects that one of those comics that has a beloved following based on the cartoon from the early 2000s,
yep,
or even the Teen Titans Go stuff,
mm-hmm,
but that they have not managed to find really top tier creators. That's another one that could use a boost.
Well, and for all that,
something
Anna,
to take them away from being just the Batman publisher.
Anna was a huge fan of Adam Glass's Teen Titans.
Right, and I like that run too.
But it just wasn't a seller.
Right.
They need some stuff that's going to hit.
Right. And we know that Tom Taylor, by the way, is not 100% guaranteed on that because his Suicide Squad run didn't.
Right. But I think that was because Suicide Squad is a lesser property.
Right.
And it launched when James Gunn movie had just came out, maybe.
Yeah. And I, the thing is, like, Deceased, like, Tom Taylor is actually a guy who knows how to do big commercial projects because Deceased is that.
Yep.
So,
and people are starting to learn his name. He has become like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and then with, you know, Bendis leaving Superman, they've got room to do a new Superman writer. Like, they clearly have been clearing the decks for this for a little while.
Wasn't there some rumors just recently that, like, was it Mark Waid or something?
There
like
were rumors
that?
About Mark Waid, and I can see that, and that'd be fantastic.
Because that would be a good call, too.
But where's Bendis going? Because he's not leaving DC.
I don't know. He can write something else. He's still writing Legion, right?
Yeah, Legion.
And like, he's got his Young Justice comic?
Or no, that's canceled.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But, like, something like that would be an okay place for him to be, I think. You know, away from the main
stuff. Here's the thing. While I didn't love it, Naomi definitely got people's attention. And I think that one of the things Bendis does well, and I'm about to both talk about how much I'm excited for DC,
yep,
and praise Bendis. It is me, I promise.
Obviously, it's some sort of
yes,
doppelganger.
The universe has been transflocked.
That's why you had to make our views clear on Trump, so we would know you're not a doppelganger.
You know it's me. But Bendis, the one thing that he's done is Jessica Jones, Miles Morales, even, much though I'm not a big fan, Maria Hill. He has created characters
that have managed to stand the test of time.
And I think that that's what he should be doing in DC. They should have him create new characters. Like, Naomi is a great new character. It is weird to me that a white Jewish man has created some of the most memorable black characters of Marvel. Riri Williams, Miles Morales.
Reinvigorated Luke Cage.
Rebranded Luke Cage. Like, he did all that work. And Jessica Jones, like, he's the one who is diversifying people's... and he can do the same thing at DC. And I think that maybe that's what he should be doing.
I agree.
I don't know if there's a position that's called just build, make new characters.
There should be, though. Character engineer.
I mean, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I think that'd be fun.
Yeah.
It's a dream job for some people.
Yeah.
Team him up with some of the best artists in the biz to come up with cool character designs.
Yep. And he usually does get to work with really good artists.
Yeah.
That's if I were Marie, that's what I would do. Mm-hmm. I would put Bendis on that job. Or basically I would give him books where the biggest thing that Bendis does is Bendis is not a big research guy. And he's not very good at working with continuity. So I'd give him books that are basically him doing his own thing. Hell, give him Hawkman.
Reminder, by the way, Naomi was co-written by David Walker.
I know. Yeah.
Randy, you know, the other thing, Tom Taylor, if they want a good Justice League launch, and they should have a good Justice League book, he would be the guy, I think.
Yeah.
But it would also be great to see him on a Green Arrow book.
Yeah, I'd love that.
Because we know he knows Green Arrow. And he likes to I think he likes to put Green Arrow up against other heroes in the DC universe to see how they bounce off each other.
You know, to be honest, Green Arrow's been so invisible for the most part. And I think the way to make Green Arrow work is either make him a big part of Justice League, like the Justice League Unlimited, or build a team around him the same way Batman has a family. Like, if you did a Green Arrow, Black Canary, maybe bring back Connor Hawk, bring in some other characters, some Black Lightning maybe. Like, do an Outsiders-y type book. Yeah. Basically build a Green Arrow family book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that would be something that might get people's attention. Give them some kind of cool name. Call them the Outlaws or whatever.
Yep.
And make that the thing. Make it a new team.
They'd be as merry men.
Green Arrow and the Outsiders.
Red Hood would want that title back.
Now watch Mary Javin will do no reboots and it'll just be like minor
same
tweaks.
Thing. That'd be disappointing.
Hopefully not, but we'll know in the next few months.
I guess we will. Alright, so let's take a break real quick and then we'll come back and talk about comics for the week. We are talking comics for the week of Wednesday, November 12th, and, November 11th, sorry, November 11th.
Get it right, Randy.
Sorry. bunch of first issues this week, and then some pretty notable second issues.
Yep.
So I'm going to start running down, as always, we'll just kind of jump around. Taskmaster number one, written by Jed McKay, who I really think Jed McKay is going to wind up being an A-lister somewhere.
He was last seen writing the Black Cat comic for Marvel.
Yep.
And I think most people listening to this know who Taskmaster is, but he was one of the like the upper tier henchman types for Marvel.
Well, but he trains henchmen. That's his whole
right
thing.
Yeah, but he also he himself kind of usually is a henchman for somebody bigger. But he has a cool power and a cool look.
Yeah.
His power is that he can duplicate any move he sees after even seeing it only once.
And he wears pirate boots.
He's got the best costume ever.
Skull mask, sword, shield.
This is his second best costume.
His best costume is this one.
His cool thing is that like he can watch Cap fight one fight, he can fight like Cap style.
Yep.
And so he's not sort of the best at anything, but he can like do all of it and combo it.
And the reason there's a miniseries is because he was going to be a big part of the Black Widow movie, which is not coming out until next year. But they finally decided to release this.
Yep.
And I'm glad they did. It's super fun. It starts off with him at like a super villain mafia golf tournament. He's like the...
Because they have those.
He's like the celebrity double... And, like, the other guy has Bullseye, and his Mafia Don has hired Taskmaster, and the Bullseye and Taskmaster are getting into kind of a fight, and then someone starts shooting at them. And it's, like, a big chase scene. He's in a golf cart. Whoever's chasing him is on a motorcycle shooting at him. There's some really fun action stuff. And then there's a big reveal of... as someone rescues him, and he finds out that he's been dropped into sort of... He's been falsely accused of something. It's a very dangerous people are hunting him.
Yep.
It's a lot of fun. I know Dave occasionally finds stuff a little wacky. This is a little on the wacky side.
Yep.
But I had a great time with it, and I'm looking forward to more.
But it's a good adventure book with good writing and good art.
I think that people in general, like, I think there's a fondness for the Taskmaster. He has, like, people who like Deathstroke and stuff like that. The other cool costumed people who were probably designed, I think both designed by George Perez in the 70s or early 80s.
If you were reading a Deadpool book in the early 2000s, he was... constantly in it because they were friends, sort of.
It makes sense.
Well, yeah, that was Bullseye, though, he's buddies with.
No, I mean, don't you remember the Udon stuff? The Taskmaster was like Deadpool. They were basically...
That was Hockey Mask Taskmaster.
That was Hockey Mask Taskmaster.
Oh, so not the real Taskmaster.
No, the real Taskmaster. The better Taskmaster than the Skullface.
For those who don't know what we're talking about, and Russell, you can just email us if you do. The Taskmaster has this classic costume that is like... And
he has a skeleton mask.
They reference it in the first couple pages here. He's like, it's a classic. I won the best skull costume 3 years running. But yeah, he's like, the skull, the cape, the pirate boots, it's a lot.
He looks a little bit like Skeletor.
Yeah. But the Udon did a redesign of him where he was like wearing a hockey mask.
But it had like a skull motif to it.
Yeah, it was a skull motif, a hockey mask, and didn't have a cape. And,
listen, if I had only ever seen that design, I would say they actually did a good design because Udonos are good designers.
It's a solid design. It's just not better than the original.
It makes him, it's one of those things where it makes everybody look like they're just a special ops guy.
Exactly. It's like X-Men black leather costumes. It's fine, but it's not as cool as yellow spandex.
Wow. You guys are so wrong.
Yeah, so the Rogues management is somewhat divided on this. Dave and I believe one thing and Nick is wrong.
If you want
to make your incorrect case for Hockey Mask Taskmaster, you can go ahead and send us that email and we'll ignore it.
But Nick will shove it in our faces for the rest of our lives.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Also this week, Aftershock has a new book called Miskatonic.
What's that about? Miskatonic University? It's all a bunch of grad students in Innsmouth.
No,
but it is a Lovecraft-themed book.
Yes.
And there was that era in the 60s and 70s when Westerns, when you started getting revisionist Westerns?
Yeah.
Well, we started getting revisionist Lovecraft stories that kind of upend a little bit of the expectations for them. So Lovecraft Country would be an example of it. And this is set earlier than that. It's set in Lovecraft's own native 1920s.
Yeah.
But I didn't get to read the whole thing, so you guys are going to be better off saying what the actual premise is.
Yeah, it's about an agent who is tasked by Hoover to sort of deal with the situation. Is it Innsmouth?
Innsmouth, yeah.
Yeah.
Meets up with a former detective.
Like a retired police
detective. So just by the way, having a female FBI agent is already a revisionist thing.
I mean, he was about to fire her, but then...
She has some kind of...
leverage.
Yeah, leverage on her.
And if you have leverage on Hoover, I mean, come on. But I really enjoyed this. I thought it was an interesting story. I'm not super familiar with Mark Sable, who's the author.
Yeah, he's written a couple things for Boom back in the day, I think.
But I was very taken with the art. The art reminds me of the other kind of Lovecraftian I.G. Colbert stuff.
Yeah.
It's got just a good solid handling of kind of mundane and the crazy.
And I know they wanted to immerse it a little bit more in the, like, social mores of the times, so that there is, like, a recognition that, like, well, like, when Lovecraft was writing the Innsmouth stories about people who had mixed breed with these fishmen.
Yeah,
that was a little bit of Lovecraft talking about, like, miscegenation and stuff like that.
It's messed up.
And they kind of bring it that more to the fore here, where you've got, like, overtly xenophobic some other agents who are like that.
Yeah.
And this is I think people are kind of rightly like. Yeah, we're going to stop kind of just doing the eerie stuff, and we're going to kind of confront some of his Lovecraft's prejudices through his own concepts.
Yeah. This is not on a level of Lovecraft Country, I should say. It's not amazing, but it's fun, and I liked it.
Yep.
You don't get a lot of Lovecraftian comics for all that is so influential.
Yeah. Right. Lots of, like, little bits and pieces here, a Shumagorath here, and I don't know what else I was going to say. Shumagorath there.
A Chthon there.
But yeah, it's a good first issue. Then there's Marvel Action Chillers, which is a beginning of a miniseries that is Halloween themed, a little bit late. But it's IDW's all ages, like, it's a spooky Halloween Marvel series. This issue features Iron Man, Riri Williams, and Doctor Strange, and it's going to lead into the next issue with, like, Cap, and I think it looks like Elsa Bloodstone.
To be fair, there was a pandemic this year. If they had to be a few weeks late, we should probably be understanding.
Halloween can live in your hearts the entire year.
That's true.
It's true.
It's true.
The other big thing, one of the big things this week, there is a new D&D book by a new writer. Is it Amy Garcia and AJ Mendez?
I believe that is correct.
And it is D&D at the Spine of the World. It is all themed around that new Rhyme of the Frostmaiden adventure.
What are they? Icewind Dale is the general location. Yep. Yeah. So yes, if you've read the Drizzt books, you know about the sort of small trading towns and barbarian tribes and monsters and stuff of the Northlands. And this uses some of those elements of that new book that D&D put out, but it's an original adventure, right? This isn't like adapting the story.
This is a new adventure with new characters like Drizzt and Brunor Battlehammer. None of those guys are in this. It is like, there's a Dragonborn Ranger.
If there's not a halfling named Regis, I'm not interested.
There's no halfling named Regis.
No.
They definitely have built up a new cast.
But it's, you know, that makes sense, and I think most D&D like readers of D&D comics are kind of like about that because you want to see new adventures. You want to create new characters.
Yeah, you remember a little while back. This is not too far back. I guess maybe like 10 years or maybe so. We used to gripe that there were no D&D comics.
Yep.
And IDW has done a good job of keeping D&D comics in print. I wish that they had a big omnibus of all the John Rogers stuff, because that stuff was really good.
It was.
It feels like it gets kind of forgotten whenever the D&D comes. Like,
is it just because it was tied to 4th edition and they're trying to sweep all that under the rug?
It might be.
The comics are essentially timeless. All it means is that there was a few more tieflings and Dragonborn than you get now. But even this new comic
has a Dragonborn.
Yeah.
So yeah, I do think it'd be nice to have that in print. But anyway, they've got, like, Jim Zub stuff that is all tied into, like, all the Ravenloft and everything else that's coming out.
Yeah.
Like, there's a good selection of D&D comics available now, and that's a good thing.
It's true.
Kick-Ass vs. Hit-Girl came out. This is that Steve Niles and Marcelo Frusan?
Steve Niles has had a few books hitting lately.
Yeah. Pretty art. And it's exactly what it says, Kick-Ass versus Hit-Girl.
Well, yeah, then this is the new Kick-Ass, so Hit-Girl is, I don't know if she's running into her for the first time or what.
But I'm not sure either.
Yep.
I am way behind on Kick-Ass. I have not read many, many issues of Kick-Ass.
And yet, I bet if you read this, it probably wouldn't throw you off too much.
It's true, it looks pretty action-heavy. Power Rangers number one, which is the follow-up to the last week's, was Mighty Morphin. This is Power Rangers. I don't know nothing about Power Rangers, so I don't know what the deal is, but they're doing kind of a big reboot of the line, a couple new thing. Nice art.
I made a sign for it, and when I was writing that from the solicit, what I understood was that this was about the original Power Rangers, and I don't know if this is something on the show, but they talked about a time when there were only three Rangers.
Oh.
And so it's just three different ones, and they're called, like, the name that they've dubbed them is the Omega Rangers.
Huh.
So,
shouldn't they be the Alpha Rangers, the early ones?
You know what? You go to hell. Omega sounds neat. anyway, that's the limit of my knowledge, though. But it may be some kind of a prequel-y type thing, a year one, perhaps.
Okay, all right.
We'll I'll ask people who actually read it.
Punchline gets a special this week.
That's Punchline from Batman, the villainess who's the, for lack of a better term, the Joker's new girlfriend after Harley dumped him.
Yep. Either of you guys take a look through this or anything?
I forgot it too.
It looks like it is a, like, post-Joker War. She's on trial or something.
Oh, interesting.
So it's not like, I assume it would be an origin.
I think there are flashbacks in it, though.
They've already done kind of an origin. There's a little bit dealing with her and sort of saying she was coerced by the Joker.
Yeah.
It involves Leslie Tompkins and also Bluebird.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Tynion is trying to make this character stick, so we'll see if he's successful.
Then there is Death Metal Infinite Hour Extreme with three X's.
That is, this is another from DC's Death Metal line.
Yep, and it's all Lobo all the time.
It seems like a very self-aware type of thing, as in the sense that it's like, Lobo, you know, all the death metal stuff has been playing into these really ridiculous over-the-top ideas that are, in fact, metal. And Lobo is the most metal character of them all.
Sure.
So, like, even in promoting this, they had Extreme written out with, like, three X's in it, and stuff like that. So it seems like they were embracing the... And, flipping through it, I did see some scene later on in it where Lobo is replaced in one page classic origins for like Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman. it looked like kind of goofy fun. Basically, you know if you like Lobo.
Yep.
Yep. This does feature the Batman who frags.
Yes.
And then there's just a bunch of follow-up stuff. So, like, what did you guys read this with you as that jumped out at you?
I wanted to mention the Warhammer 40K comic called Marnius Kelgar. That's the name of like sort of one of the big Ultramarine heroes. And this was a really cool second issue. This is, you know, the notable thing about this series is written by Kieran Gillen, who's both done notable Marvel work, but also but has really like
indie
made
guy.
His name on indie stuff like
Wicked Plus Divine,
Wicked and Divine, and Die. Right?
Yep,
is that
yep.
him?
Mm-hmm.
So. Man. And he is a gamer who is also a Warhammer 40K gamer.
Yep.
Anyway, there are intrigues in the present with the Ultramarines dealing with a sort of like a insurrection of chaos on this planet that happens to be the home planet of the hero in this. But the big thing that happens in this second issue is it's a flashback that shows intrigues and plot twists that involve his childhood training. Which is just like this brutal regimen where they're like, they fully intend for kids who are like in their early teens or maybe not even teenagers yet to get killed in the push to become a space marine, and then only the best will survive. Only there's a sort of a big thing that happens during the training this time in this with some notable twists and turns that I thought were pretty cool.
I don't know my Warhammer 40K lore, but it was an interesting twist.
Yeah,
and also we get some Jonathan Hickman style info dumps and graphics of like history of the Warhammer.
I actually
universe.
Think his I think these info dumps have been really good because they're actually one of the things I like. They're brief.
I was going to say, they're not like Jonathan Hickman's in that I like them.
There's one that's a good overview of literally like a quick history of the Space Marines in like four or five like short paragraphs, just starting with like the Emperor creating creating them for the Great Crusade,
yep.
Then the Horus Heresy, and then the kind of extended war that's been, you know, going on for like thousands of years now. But it does real quick catch you up on who the big players are, and there's lots of neat stuff.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And some bad guys who are very bad. I'm gonna say you want to have bad guys who are really mean, and the scene where they like get the tech priest or whatever to send out a communique for them to keep him alive, and then just instantly kill him afterwards.
Yep.
I mean, I know that's his classic villain thing, but it's just nastier when they do that. They're bastards. I hope that some zealot-like space marines just empty their bolters into him later on. That will probably happen.
I think that's probably very likely. Seven Secrets number 4 came out. That is Tom Taylor's sort of action-y, superhero-y book for Boom that I'm really digging.
Yeah.
The first issue was really good.
I just caught up on
got a big
that.
Surprise.
Yeah, I caught up on episodes 3 and 4, and it's just a good book.
It is. It's really good.
I love the characters, the design work. It could easily be... I could see this easily being, like, a HBO or whatever.
They could do that.
Series.
There's Iron Man number 3, which continues... Iron Man is continuing to sort of soul search with the help of Patsy Walker, and then he faces off with a bunch of his classic villains toward the end.
Yep.
This still has that really pretty sort of painted looking artwork.
It's very cool looking. Yeah, I see like old school villains like the Living Laser and Unicorn, and is that Controller?
Oh, I was gonna say, do they?
Is that Blizzard? That's Controller. I think.
Yeah, that's my favorite. There's a big villain who's an Avengers villain I'm not used to seeing very often, who has put together a cadre of Tony's like big foes.
Yeah,
Controller is such a cool looking villain.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, and I'm gonna throw in on because X of Swords continues as always.
Ten of Swords,
whatever.
X of Tens.
And that's occurring in Excalibur, Wolverine, and Marauders. Hickman and Teeny Howard and Ben Percy and Jerry Dugan sort of pull the rug out from under people a little bit in this one. Huh. And I was surprised and pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, you were saying that this is broadly meant to be staged as this supernatural war between the X-Men and some of these people from, what do they call it, Other Realm or Outer World? Or
it takes place in Other World, which is basically the world of Saturnine and Captain Britain.
Yeah, it's
but it's against Akari, which is the opposite of Krakoa, and right. The residents there, namely Apocalypse's wife and children.
Right. But this was meant to be staged as a series of sort of mortal combats with magical swords.
Yep.
And you said that they go abroad and afield from that in this one.
But it is a lot of backstabbing and kind of Game of Thrones stuff. Wolverine is pretty prominent, which I think is really interesting. But
the fun stuff you told me about was the stuff that sounded to me, it reminded me of, like, for anybody who read back in the day when the X-Men went to Asgard, or the New Mutants went to Asgard, and there was fun stuff, like, you said there's, like, a drinking contest and stuff like that, and it sounded like they were having some fun with the fantasy setting.
Yep, they are, and I'm having my doubts that Saturnine is a good person anymore. I think she's a villainous.
Isn't she like a space Nazi or something?
I don't think she's a space Nazi.
She has a Nazi duplicate, though.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, she has a twin who is, like, the evil Nazi. She's literally, like, a cross-time Nazi.
Oh, wow. I didn't know about this.
Yeah.
My knowledge of Saturnine and Otherworld is central.
I wonder if it's possible that because that was the thing that Alan Moore and Claremont both did, was they did a switcheroo where he thought he was dealing with his ally, Opal Saturnine.
Yeah.
It was actually, in fact, Saturnine, who is, like, the evil Nazi version.
It could and I wonder be if that's that she's supplanted. Doing. Yeah, it's possible.
Yeah. Switcheroo again. That'd be a classic nod to X-Men stuff.
Yeah.
Also worth noting that we did get second printings of the early stuff, which we've not had, which sold out really fast. The first, like, is it parts 3, 4, and 5, which is
Hellions and Cable.
No, Wolverine, X-Force, and Marauders.
Oh, okay.
We have not gotten Hellions and Cable, I believe, is next week. And then we'll have everything.
Don't trick him, Nick.
I'm
You tricked him.
I guess I'm trying.
This one is, unfortunately, I know there's not a lot of people buying it so far, but the second issue of Getting It Together, which is like the romance series being done in Image, comes out. It's just as much fun as the first one. It's really good. I'm hoping people will catch on to this.
Oh, I need to read that. I really like the first issue of it.
Yeah, it's really good. Amazing Spider-Man has issue 52 and also issue 52.LR, mm-hmm. which is frustrating, but I'm enjoying this story. As Spider-Man is finally confronting the Kindred, who is like this very demonic bad guy. Marvel Zombies Resurrection wraps up, and that was really good. And Savage Avengers, I forget how much I love Savage Avengers until an issue comes out, but this issue has Magic and Conan recruiting, and they're working on behalf of Doctor Strange. They're trying to stop Kool and Goth. They recruit Black Knight, who's a favorite character of mine, and they recruit Juggernaut to fight an Asgardian dragon because they're trying to grab all the Eyes of Agamotto. It's super fun. It's got really nice art by Patrick Zurcher. This book is so good. It is basically fantasy in the Marvel Universe. Also, Black Knight, they come up on him, and he is undercover in a bunch of KKK, and he just ransacks them.
Oh, nice.
And he's talking about, he's like, here's how it works. The first time I show up means urgent care for you. If I need to show up a second time, you're getting rung up for a lengthy hospital stay. Third time means these sheets are your burial shrouds.
Nice. I wonder if that was an intentional thing since, you know, like, Crusader imagery has been appropriated by white supremacists.
I think it probably is, yeah.
I would be happy to see the Black Knight put sword to him.
But yeah, it's cool. I love the Black Knight.
Dane Whitman.
Yep. That's everything I've got.
All right, cool. Yeah. Well, shall we move on to topics?
Yeah, we'll take a break and then we'll come back and talk about topics. Okay, so this week we don't have like a lot of like new TV. Mandalorian's going strong. Discovery's going strong.
Yeah, people should be watching both of those.
Yes, agreed.
Baby Yoda eats anything he can get his hands on.
He does. That was messed up.
It's controversial.
Was it controversial?
Some people are talking about how much they didn't like the episode because he was out there eating the baby's eggs.
Well, they
I took
to
it for the dark, humorous intent that it was clearly behind it.
I think they had to counterbalance all the Baby Yoda cuteness. He's got to have a flaw.
He is, you know, I think just like Yoda himself in Empire Strikes Back, Yoda was mischievous.
Yes.
He was just a mischievous little bastard. And Baby Yoda, even though he is not literally Yoda, we all know, is also a mischievous bastard. Clearly, his people are mischievous bastards.
There was talk of this. There was a meme going around, basically like that when Yoda died, like all the creatures on Dagobah breathed a sigh of relief because he was like the apex predator of that planet. Like, man, that's great.
That's funny.
Because yeah, when we first see him, he's like. They did the Pai Mei thing. He was like a...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He tricked Luke into thinking that he was just some rando dude.
Yep.
And B, like, he was like playing crazy man. He would, like, beat up R2 with his stick and stuff like that.
Yep.
It was only, like, when he got all zen and lifted the X-Wing up, you're like, holy shit.
Yeah. Maybe it was like the baby would be eating eggs.
But definitely watch both of those shows.
Yeah, and Discovery, I think we are all just loving Discovery.
There was a really excellent episode recently.
But in the meantime, Nick's watched a couple movies because he's Nick, and Nick watches 100 movies a day.
I do.
Pray tell, have you seen?
And Dave's playing an older video game because that's what Dave does.
I mean, it's not like a super old game. I think it's what?
It's like a year.
Is it a year? I thought it was less than that.
No, it's less than a year, right?
Maybe so.
Came out this year.
John was playing it, and that was like 6 or 7 months ago.
Yeah, that sounds about right. It's not even an old game.
That's actually good for you.
It's an old game.
I mean, if you're going by technology standpoints, then it's like if it's been out like a week or two.
And then Dave and I played a board game we've been wanting to play and had a great time with it.
Yeah.
So let's start with the board game. Let's talk about Unmatched Heroes of Legend.
Yes, this is a series of games that allow you to take champions from different periods of time, fictional characters, some from Legend, some from shows like Buffy.
Yep.
Like Buffy, Robin Hood, Bigfoot, Sinbad.
There's a special Bruce Lee that you can get.
Bruce Lee. There's an Sherlock Alice in Holmes. Wonderland with a sword. Sherlock Holmes. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Dracula.
And you essentially have a battlefield and they go mano a mano, sometimes backed up by like some servants or allies.
Yeah,
like
they always have an ally.
Yeah, like Merlin would be one, or...
like Muldoon in the Jurassic Park one. He's got engine operators.
Yep.
So basically, you've got these miniatures that represent the guy. You've got a stack of cards that represent your moves.
Yep.
And you got a little life dial.
Yep. And it's by the way, beautifully produced by Mondo. So that's just one of the draws is just how lovely the maps and characters look. There's great miniatures that you could use for any RPG for these. They're super high quality. You start out on the map, and the random element is that you'll draw like a hand of five cards initially, and your hand will grow and shrink, can't ever go over seven.
Right.
But those are your moves, and some of them are moves specific to your sidekicks.
Right.
So like when I played King Arthur in one of these, our first match was King Arthur versus Sinbad.
Yep.
And we were kind of it's a battle between that took place on the castle walls of like Camelot with Sinbad's ship like kind of pulled up against them. Like he was staging a raid or something.
Right, and you played King Arthur, and your sidekick was Merlin.
Yep.
And I played Sinbad, and my sidekick was a porter.
Yes. And, you have a deck of cards, and by the way, when the deck runs out, if you are still fighting then, and it came close both times.
You die in, like, two rounds.
Yeah, basically, if you can't draw a card, you go down by, like, 2 hit points. And these characters have, like, 16 hit points, 12 hit points, you know, a little bit more, a little less, depending on who they are.
I think I died of not having cards in the second one, actually.
You did. So you can, like, an opponent can sort of run out the clock if they've got more cards, or they have something that makes you discard cards, which I did in the second one.
Yeah, well, and in our first battle where I was playing Sinbad, he's very mobile.
Yeah.
And there was a point at which you were just slightly lower in health, and I'm like, all I gotta do is keep running around and stay away from you.
Yep.
And I will outlast you.
Right. And so that made me kind of do some risky things. Like, I only had a few cards in my hand, Randy didn't know, but like sometimes I would have like no attacks in them or no defenses. So if he were to attack me, then I would take the full brunt of it. And but I was having to kind of do risky things like get in your face. There was an attack that if it had gotten through would have done just ridiculous damage.
Yeah,
it would have destroyed I tried me. It twice and neither time did it work. But like had it worked, it would have been awesome.
But like early in the fight, before we knew what the cards were, you did use your massive biggest attack, Excalibur, against my poor porter.
Yes, it disintegrated him to pieces. then over time you harried me down and you took out Merlin and yeah. then and then suddenly yeah I was like oh this is kind of going a little bit badly for me and yeah. and you were Sinbad was coming in with the slices and took out King Arthur.
Yeah, I did not
Classic
think I was going to win that
overconfident.
Right, that's true.
But then we played the other two.
We flipped the map over and we did the one that's kind of like the Wonderland map.
Yeah,
a little
it's like
bit
a
more.
Garden.
Yeah, it has like a sort of a labyrinth maze and stuff like that. And by the way, there is a neat system for determining what section of the you're on, because some characters are close combat and some characters are ranged. And basically, if you're in the same color-coded area as somebody who's ranged, they can shoot at you.
And this particular map had like several that were three-color spaces, which meant that if Dave's Medusa got on one of the three-color spaces, he could fire almost anywhere on the board, because any of those three colors were within range.
Yeah, and those tended to be on like sort of these intersections that tended to be like towers and things. Yeah. So that second match was Medusa with her, she had a trio of harpies mm-hmm. with her, mm-hmm. versus your Alice in Wonderland,
yep.
who, by the way, looks like a video game version of Alice, because she had like a big old sword, yep. which was like the Vorpal Blade, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah.
And as like her ally, the Jabberwock.
Yeah.
By the way, I believe not historically the case.
No.
In fact, she killed the Jabberwock.
She did. Yeah.
But no,
well,
it's
her herald.
I mean, that's you can work up whatever crazy story
but
you
also,
need.
Her big power is just she can grow or shrink, and when she's shrunk, she has a higher defense. When she's grown, she does higher attacks. And there's all kinds of cards that let you shrink or grow. The idea, I think, is she's carrying around like the potions to change
yep.
size.
And Medusa's big thing was that she had ranged attack arrows. And also this really nasty thing that was sort of that I chipped away at Alice and her ally with yep. a lot, where if you're in the same area with her when her turn starts, you just lose a point of hit points because she is slowly petrifying you.
Yep.
And there's like straight up attacks that do like more serious petrification damage. But this was one where all I had to do was keep on kind of running into your territory, being just far enough to rain down arrows,
yep.
but just close enough that you still got the petrification thing. And I was sort of using my harpies as a buffer so you couldn't get close to her.
Yeah.
And the harpies were actually very easy to kill, but by the time you took them all down, they had kind of done some damage.
Yeah, for sure.
But it was another close fight. I thought these were both satisfying battles.
Yeah.
In the end, Medusa, I think because maybe it was because those are supposed to be like poisoned arrows or something like that, had a lot of attacks that made you discard a card.
Yeah.
Well, in this game, the deck is your hit point, your lifeblood, basically.
Yeah.
And so suddenly you had like no cards left and I had
like six or eight. Yeah.
Which is actually a fair amount in this game
yeah.
to have to work with. And so, yeah, in the end, Alice was dying slowly of poison,
I assume. She exhausted herself, and then
yep.
you probably came up with an arrow in her head.
Yep, no doubt.
Our turn to stone.
But it was cool. We really liked it, and we could immediately see all the possibilities of the crazy stuff of, like, having raptors from Jurassic Park versus Sinbad
yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah, you can use whatever map. You can combine them. Like, it's a fairly straightforward game system.
It's mainly one-on-one, but you can also do, like, a team where it's, like
two-on-two.
Yeah.
yeah. But yeah, it was a lot of fun. We're now looking forward to trying some of the other ones. Unfortunately, it's a little hard. It's a lot of print right now. We have the Jurassic Park one, and we're about to get the Robin Hood versus Bigfoot one back in.
Yep.
And then the Buffy one should be hitting us at the end of the month.
Yep. I now that we've tried it, I think it's a lot of fun. And some of the best production and just box design.
Yeah.
Like once you repack it and stuff, like you're like, oh, this is really cleverly done. Everything slots in so nicely, and all the character stuff is together.
Yeah.
So
Nick,
recommend it.
Tell us about movies you've been watching.
Yeah, we watched a couple of horror movies this weekend.
But October is over. You cannot horror.
You can horror anytime you want.
There's some horror in this house.
I watched a movie called The Dark and the Wicked.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I forget his name, but he's the director that did the movie Monster and the movie The Strangers.
Okay.
Monster is about that cross-country mom and daughter.
Right. With a surprisingly kind of emotional, personal story
yeah.
told with the backdrop of this kind of creepy creature stalking them.
Yeah, and that seems to be sort of what this director does. He's got a little bit of Ty West in him, so...
Slower pacing?
Slower pacing, kind of downer endings.
Yeah.
But this... I have not seen a movie that has been such, like, laden with dread than this movie. It's
what
dark.
About Judge Dredd?
Well, there's Judge Dredd, sure. But, you know, it was really good.
There's something to be said for that.
But it's about, basically, this family, a house, and them dealing with sort of... Their father is dying of cancer. Their mother is acting very strangely and talking about people talking to her at night. And it turns out there is some sort of malevolent being that is slowly poisoning this house.
Hmm.
And I don't want to say too much more, but... This just the cinematography is great. The characters feel very real and how they kind of react to sort of things emotionally.
That movie Monster was sometimes the dialogue felt weirdly realistic, like yeah. fascinatingly real. Like that was like its strength to me was like how kind of like these characters that were like kind of very roughly estranged felt to each other. And I was it was. It was fascinating because you usually don't get characters that were quite, I don't know, so real in a way.
Yeah, and where that movie was just dealing with sort of a relationship between one person or two people.
Yep.
This one's dealing with a whole family and just some odds and ends, and it takes turns I wasn't expecting.
Dysfunctional family? Is that his thing?
Kind of, not really in this one. It's. They may be a little estranged at times
okay.
in places.
I was just curious.
But there was sort. There's still sort of. You know, love between all the characters in some fashion.
Yeah.
But it was dark, and I had to watch... It was good. I just had to watch something really light afterwards, because it is kind of like, oh, God. but a definite recommend for me. It's...
Say the name again?
The Dark and the Wicked. It's a Shudder film... produced, but it's actually like a movie theater one as opposed to...
Where do you watch it?
You can rent it off of VOD at the moment.
Okay.
And you can rent it for like $6 or $7. It's one of their lower tiered ones. It's good though. The other movie I watched was a movie called Alone. I'd heard some things about this one and I kind of piqued my interest because it was not so much a horror but a sort of a suspense about a woman who's kind of trying to escape her life for reasons that I don't want to spoil.
Yep.
And she goes on sort of a cross-country trek and runs afoul of a individual that weirdly starts to sort of pop up in all the places she's at.
Uh-huh.
And basically is hunting her.
Okay.
And it goes to some really kind of... places that you don't think you really want it to go.
Oh.
And some scenes that are hard to watch.
Okay.
But it's really good.
Is this a new... Is this like an update of The Hitcher?
I mean, it might have some same vibes of that. It's also filled with actors that you... There's one I recognized. He was recently in the Outsider on HBO.
Yep.
But they're all sort of lower-tiered actors...
A lot of times I like that, especially in horror suspense type stuff, just because you're not paying attention to any star power, you're just into the characters.
Right. And that's, I think, was a big draw for it. I'm trying to look up who the... Anthony Heald is in it. The guy from Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, yeah.
And
as
one of the guys. But, oh man, who is the...
What's the name of this movie again?
Alone. And... It's just
kind
of foreboding nature, but it's directed by John Hyams, which I didn't recognize.
Any relation to Peter Hyams?
Yeah, I was going to say, Peter Hyams did a bunch of stuff.
It's possible.
You know, Randy, I just want a quick side bring up. I don't know if you ever mentioned this in the podcast, but you, I know, somewhat recently got around to watching The Invitation, and I think
yes.
you quite like that.
Yep.
And that was another horror movie that is really kind of more suspense than full horror.
Yeah.
But it's, like, really enthralling. It's all conversational.
Yeah.
But it's really draws
it
you in.
A great sense of menace. It was really good. He is the son of Peter Hyams.
Yeah, son of all Peter right. Hyams. Yep. But he's done a few things, some TV, some lower budget stuff. I definitely will keep an eye on him because... It was really, really good. And definitely worth watching.
Okay.
All right. I think that's all we got this week. No, we don't, actually. Dave was going to talk about Ghosts of Tsushima.
Ghosts of Tsushima is a samurai video game that probably it's a pretty A-list game, so I think people probably mostly know about it. But if you don't, it is this was both good and bad for me. It is clearly modeled on the format of, say, Red Dead Redemption or Grand Theft Auto. Uh-huh. It is an open world thing that has like key storylines, but that also allows you to go anywhere you want. It's just that if you do that, like I did, willy nilly, you'll get your ass kicked. But it has actually a good story to it, and like really, just the production values are so good and so amazing that that. Like, if you ever wanted to be a samurai in a video game, this is the one to play. What was I going to say? So the premise, it starts out that you kind of learn the basics of it in a battle where the samurai lose, basically. Mongols are invading your island of Tsushima, which is in their step to invading Japan. And they tear through your samurai... and take your uncle prisoner, and then the rest of the game is kind of an ongoing effort to rally people, raise an army of specialists to rescue your uncle and
stop
the Mongols.
Your uncle's like your father figure, right?
Absolutely. Basically. There's flashbacks where you train, and you will have flashbacks where it's like him training you when you were a kid, but it's also how you learn controls of new techniques and stuff you're gonna like use in the present.
Mm-hmm.
Incidentally, this is one of those games where you can play it in different modes. There's like it just looks stunningly beautiful most of the time. Some of the best environments I've ever seen in a game. But you can play it Kurosawa mode, where it's in black and white, and even has the like sort of slightly staticky look of like a 50s, 60s film.
Okay.
They do all the kind of things you would want in a samurai game, or to evoke the era. So. It, you know, in its essence, you learn new moves as you go along. You do things to build up, you know, your swordsmanship. So you'll be doing simple strikes early on, but just like one of those Arkham games, you're going to learn advanced techniques and how to deal with guys with spears or shields and stuff like that, how to cut through their defenses. And there's even some sort of lightly magic stuff. And I understand that they've added some supernatural quests in there now that weren't in there originally, but you get them for free though.
I was going to ask about that. If there was like supernaturally.
Yeah. I haven't messed with them yet, but yes, several of the towns I've been to have a person you can talk to who can send you on supernatural missions.
Is it, and I don't know that you'll know this, is it like Japan, like a historical, or is it like a fake Japan?
I do not know. It's in the island of Tsushima, which would be an island off of Japan, and whether that's invented or not, I don't know. I bet it might be invented.
Yeah.
If there is a Tsushima, I'm really sorry. I didn't know. But they... anyway, as far as the doing all the different things, so there are, like... One of the ways you raise your health by finding, like, hot springs and going to them. There's, like... fun Japanese lore, like, you know, the foxes that they have in Japan, mm-hmm. like, where you can find these fox shrines and actually befriend delightful little foxes on the island. You will, like, as far as, like, the sort of more zen side of some of this stuff, there's actually a sequence where I composed a haiku. Now, it had a, what happens is you look around and there's, like, sort of areas on the map, like, areas ahead of you in this really beautiful area. Because you're supposed to be zen, you know, doing some sort of meditation stuff.
Uh-huh.
And when you look at them, like it focuses in on them, and it'll show you a line beneath them. Or basically, you will choose, like, oh, do I want to talk about the sun? Do I want to talk about the trees? How about the water down here? And it will give you lines. You're not literally like one of those magnetic poems putting together one. But you choose sort of three areas of focus in the natural setting around you, and then you'll hear your guy say it with this very deep, meaningful recitation, and it's really cool sounding.
And when you finish your haiku, does it become a massive special attack? Extreme haiku destruction!
It is not that goofy, but, like, everything you do in this does have a practical effect. So, like, you do probably gain, like, I think resolve is their thing that you use for special attacks or to heal yourself when you need to. You draw upon it. It's like your commerce and resource and stuff like that. You'll also start out with broken armor, and you'll repair your armor over time, and you'll learn to use a bow. Here's the other big thing. I guess I should have said this early on, is that you are a samurai who is so overmatched in this that you have to work together with a thief who saves you early on, this lady thief who's an interesting character. All of this, by the way, has strong writing and strong characters. And by the way, they seem to go out of their way to be gender equal in a way that probably isn't accurate to the era.
Yeah.
But like the person who gave me the first cool armor I got was a female blacksmith. Hmm. Don't know if that was at all anything with any historicity to it, but they're just a little bit more gender equal in this version of feudal Japan. But you learn kind of ninja-type techniques from the thief, and your guy clearly does not want to do them at first, and you'll even have some flashbacks sometimes where you'll see your uncle saying, always look an opponent in the eye, never ever stab them from behind, that's the worst thing you could do.
Never but be a ninja.
You will have to be a ninja in this game, too. So, yes, you learn stealth techniques and samurai techniques, and you have really kind of an option to do either one of them. And there's just... they've thought of, like, everything in this game. When you find a bunch of Mongols to fight, you have an option to activate a standoff. The standoff is that thing where the camera swings around to the side and you have the two samurais facing off, like, 20 feet apart. And it kind of goes into this sort of bullet time. And it's like a shootout in, like, Red Dead Redemption. And it's the controls are pretty simple, but when they draw for their sword, that's when they kind of go into bullet time for a split second. And if you then release the button at the right time, you will insta one-hit kill them. And it looks real cool. You do that one-hit slash where you're all confident looking. Yep. But as the game has gone along, they've started doing feints where they'll look like they're going to attack, but they don't. And if you attack too early, then they're going to get attack in. They will not die. But you can, because you can bump up everything in your character and you can choose what paths of attack, whether you want to be more ninja-y or more samurai-y, or even just, there's all sorts of other cool things you can put the points into, even flute playing.
Ooh.
I now can chain an attack so that when I get those standoff duels, they have it where a second person in the group of what could be like eight Mongols or whatever will also attack, and I can do in the same sort of bullet time thing, take him down, and I can advance that more where I think I will actually be able to take down like three or four guys in this just ridiculous super slow-mo attack.
But what if... well, how's your flute playing?
The first one I got, I think, is one that's... it's almost like a little like Legend of Zelda. I think changes the time of day and will like shift it to night or day. Because there's a day-night cycle. It rains and is beautiful. It's sunlight is beautiful. There's cherry blossoms. There's trees with like golden fall leaves and stuff like that. But also these like dark and dangerous areas. Because you like find a lot of towns the Mongols have ransacked. But the stories are all really good. The downside for me is that these kind of games, there's like so many options. You will sometimes be on your way to do a main mission, and like five people will give you quests on the way. And that like is a little frustrating to me, because I'm like, I'm going to have to put 40 hours into this minimum, right? And I want like a 20-hour game. It is super well done, and at this point I'm in for a penny, in for a pound, because I know... if I walk away from this game for even a week or two, I will forget all the moves I have learned.
Dave, I think you're in for a yen.
So Tsushima is a real island. It okay. is off the coast of Japan.
My apologies.
Sorry, Tsushima.
And this does take place in during the first Mongol invasion of Japan in 1274. So it's taking place during a real event.
Okay.
But obviously the story
is... fictionalized story.
No, Dave, what you're doing is real.
I'm changing history.
You're changing history even as we speak.
Oh my gosh, I better not screw this one up. unless you are an even more time miser than I am on video games and don't like to play long games, and I don't think it's going to be super long. I think it's like 40 hours is actually pretty reasonable for a game these days. But there's a lot to like in this game. I my only problem is that I'm getting my butt kicked a little too much, but I think I overcame, I hit a certain point where I'm like, okay, my armor's better, I've learned some better fighting techniques, and I just know the engine better, and now my samurai feels kind of badass, and it's pretty cool.
See, Dave, what you need to do is do what I did, which is have a teenage boy at the house.
Yes.
And then just buy games and occasionally watch him play them.
Yes, what were you watching him play recently? Oh, the Lord of the Rings one.
You got the Shadows of Mordor was the free game this winter.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was the second Shadows of Mordor, yep. I don't know. So I came home, and he has been playing like all day. The controller was almost out of batteries, and he's got all these cool special abilities.
That game is also similar in sort of the way it works to this game. So, Randy, what I should do is really just let you borrow this when I'm done, and you can go and watch him play it.
Yeah.
This is probably as good a samurai game as you're going to get.
Yeah.
So, there you have it.
All right, that'll do it for us this week. We'll be back next week with more. Until that time,
yo, show.
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.